Hey, J. Crew, the Book of Life has been closed for a whole nother year. A whole nother, as they say. So we might as well swear a little. You know, we've got time. We're not going to make it all year, so we might as well start swearing now. So this has been your obscenity warning.
You guys, I have to get sinus surgery.
You do,
isn't
really?
That effed up? Yeah.
That is effed up.
Is that cover for an...
Sorry,
is that a deviated septum?
No, I have a deviated septum. He's like, but it has nothing to do with your problems. And I'm like, that's like pretty bittersweet to find out now.
That's right.
I'm sorry. I just like sinus problems, eh? Deviated septum?
No, literally.
Hello, J. Crew. This is Unorthodox, the world's leading Jewish podcast. I am your host, Mark Oppenheimer, joined this week by Tablet senior writer Liel Leibowitz.
Hello, hello.
And deputy editor Stephanie Butnick.
Hi.
Hello. And our Jew of the week, this is, guys, it's a good week. It's a good week. Our Jew of the week is former Obama speechwriter David Litt, who was kind of responsible for a lot of the jokes in Obama's speeches and basically for anything Jewish. That was like his niche. Our Gentile of the week is Russia expert Tom Nichols, who's going to talk to us about, you know, how to save the world. So it's going to be a great, great show. But first, I don't know, what's up? Anything going on with you guys?
I mean, I spent the day yesterday with my little nephew Noah, who is just like the cutest person in the entire world. And he's like
five
months.
3 months now?
He's like five months. So he's like a real person. And he just like looks at you and laughs and does this like crooked half smile. And I'm like, oh, you are going to be dangerous one day.
The sort of like, how you doing?
But it's hard because we were walking and my sister was holding her dog on the leash and I was steering the stroller. And
it is like, you were holding the baby on a leash?
Yeah, and I was having a lot of trouble like navigating this. Strollers are big. Like we went into a store and I was like, wow, these aisles are just not baby friendly. Like, and
now I have to ask.
Yeah.
I have to ask, you're probably not in the stroller conversation yet, nor should you be.
We all should get out of the stroller conversation.
Right. But is your sister
politely but firmly request?
Are you like, has there been stroller, you know, are you aware of what brand she has?
I remember it being a thing that she, like, I remember hearing it. There was some spreadsheet that her friends all share, like one that like all the products they use and then they all add to it. So to me, that's like all like the Harvard Law School moms now.
Wait, is it actually the list? It's not like an Upper East Side thing. It's not a particular shul. It's the organizing principle of this shared Google spreadsheet is Harvard Law moms.
No, it's just like her friends from law school who had babies before her. One of them made a spreadsheet and then just passes it
amazing.
Around now. And my sister's like, you know, loves a good spreadsheet, added to it, added all her friends' input. It's very funny. So now it's expanded to actually Columbia undergrad as well.
How did we go? How did we go from, you know, get child away from wolf to put child in $1,300 stroller? Like, in like three generations, like that's it.
I have a story that my stroller story of my own. When we were expecting Rebecca, so this is going back over 10 years now.
That was like amateur hour.
Amateur, like we had no idea what we were doing, right? This is Mark 1.0 or 1.1. We were sitting on the sofa one night. I think we were watching an episode of 24 or something, and the kind of show you don't watch after you have kids.
Just to relax.
Right, just to relax. And sit at her laptop open, and I looked over, she had like 50 little windows open, which is not really how she rolls laptop-wise. And I noticed that she had every single one of them was a different stroller brand. And I think she had created a spreadsheet, and she was typing furiously fast. And finally, she just said, I don't know what stroller to get. And I realized all of a sudden there was this moment of clarity, and she'd been talking about strollers for weeks. And I realized, oh,
this is not about the stroller.
This is not about the stroller. Like, Sid doesn't care about stuff at all. Like, her perseverating about a material acquisition, this is not about the acquisition. And I looked at her and I said, sweetie, I don't think it's the stroller that you're scared of.
And you know that it's
like small monster inside.
So her eyes filled up with tears and she said, I think you're right. And aww. She just let me buy the stroller. I took the stroller off her hands.
Wait, do you have one of those strollers that has like six kids involved? Like how
we have a
advanced?
Double-decker. So we never had more than two. You can do three. You can do two underneath, one perched on top on a pole, basically. We went
like
Phil and Ted's kind of, yeah, kind of on a flagpole sitting sort
one,
of.
One kid's tied up on top on the mast.
The Romney. We'll get to that later.
The dog on the Irish setter on top of the car. All right. Some news of the Jews, perhaps. I'm just going to kick this off. This is we aim to serve a little bit of service journalism here, New York Magazine style. ModernTribe.com is offering a $36,000 yarmulke called the Kippah, not a Kippah, the Kippah. The It reads on the website, at $36,000, the kippah is the most expensive yarmulke ever created. The handcrafted yarmulke made with conflict-free diamonds, white gold, and supple navy leather definitely warrants the price tag. And it's like a Star of David on top in diamonds.
I love this. I can almost imagine like the QVC ad.
Do you want everyone to know that not only are you Jewish, you're like kind of a dick. Right. They do say it's like, you know, for like Drake or... You know, Andy Cohen, I think, is someone else they suggest this for.
It's for the financially advantaged Jew.
Yeah. I mean, I just would love to, like, I wonder which synagogue you'd see this at and, like, what you would say. You'd be like, excuse me, is that double
high yarmulke?
Thousand worth of diamonds on your head?
Speaking of quality Jews, Bethany Frankel, who's she again? She's Real Housewives of something?
She's Real Housewives of New York City, then went off the show, then went back on. She's also the purveyor of Skinny Girl margaritas, which I'm pretty sure is just like chemicals in a can.
She's the Bob Dylan of the Real Housewife franchise, you know? On again, off again, poetic, mysterious.
She's Jewish, she's Christian, she's Jewish, she's Christian. She flew to Puerto Rico with her own chartered plane of supplies to help people, which basically makes her a better human being than the president.
She deserves
a double chai yarmulke is what she deserves.
I think we should outsource all of the federal government's work to the Real Housewife franchise. Because that would do an amazing work. We would all be like fit and skinny, like a little bit bitchy, but awesome.
No, it's true. And if you watch the show, which I'm not sure if you guys do, but like, you know, they're always like planning galas. They have real organizational skills.
I mean,
we
these
can get
women,
them together and lead, you know, legions of like aid workers, right? Like
these
that
women
would be
are executives. Like that's what they do. They plan and they execute.
And I actually don't think they do the Melania like show up in stilettos. I think they would wear like a cute, expensive like wedge sneaker.
That's right.
You know, way more practical.
And their husbands in the chai yarmulke.
Well, the nice thing about the chai yarmulke is it's actually a great way to travel with lots of money across international borders.
That's right.
You're only allowed to take so much cash on an airplane, but who's going to question the chai yarmulke? It's like, I mean, Puerto Rico, of course, being part of the United States, not necessary, but for the next international aid situation.
Housewives.
Speaking of international situations, six Nobel laureates this year were Jews, I believe. I mean, there are people who track these things.
According to the email you got from your crazy uncle.
That's right.
You see, all the Jews win the Nobels and all the Nobels are Jews.
One of them is Michael Rosbach, who teaches at Brandeis. And then there's the physicist Rainer Weiss of MIT. Both of them had parents who fled the Holocaust. Thus, which gives me a great chance to bring up Robin Williams' famous line. He used to tell the story about being on this German TV show. And the host asked him, you know, why is it that Germans are not so funny? And he said, did you ever think you killed all the funny people? And it's, you know, and what's the best part of it is the follow-up where the woman looked at him and didn't get the joke. And she said, nine. Like she – thus proving his point.
Like, there you go.
I also just want to give a shout-out to apparently Jewish Nobel laureate Kip Thorne of Caltech. I mean, we're naming Jews Kip Thorne now? That's straight out of my prep school circa 1990. That's amazing.
I mean, that's what the Nobel is for. It's most awesome name, Nobel.
My favorite
they give those out.
My favorite thing about Rosbach, this scientist, he said something, you know, at a prize in like 2013, he sort of explained his family's story a little bit. And he says this, and this is the guy who wins the Nobel Prize. Like, this is a guy who does not mess around. He wrote, a one sentence summary of these events is that after some years of trouble and considerable hard work, my parents established a satisfactory, if not comfortable, life for themselves and their two children.
Some years of trouble.
I'm like, wow, you are like a scientist. Like you, that is just... You don't even need citations.
Some years of discomfort, you know, between my Donegan and Treblinka, but you know they're fine now.
Yeah, that's a guy who's got his
county. They're good.
That's a guy who's got his eyes on the prize. He just, yep, there were some troubles, and then we got to work.
So here's the thing: I also propose a new. This is not like a law; it's like a bylaw. It's like a regulation. You are not allowed to boast and claim, oh, did you see how many Jews won the Nobel? Unless you could actually explain in two sentences what the fuck it is that they do.
Look, they had some considerable trouble, and then after that, they had a relatively comfortable discovery. I get no doubt. All Our Gentile this week is Tom Nichols. He's a professor at the U.S. Naval War College. He specializes in Russia and the former Soviet Union. He's written a bunch of books. His latest is called The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. He's also a 5-time undefeated Jeopardy champion. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
And has a very Gentile name. I mean, we always have to note, if you've got a guy named Tom Nichols,
yeah,
Tom, you're not a Jew.
Well, we picked it up at Ellis Island, I think precisely on those criteria.
So here's my first question. Is a 5-time Jeopardy champion, is this like the equivalent of a 4-star general? Like, is there a hierarchy in the Jeopardy community?
Yes. I was actually one of the, until the 90s, until they opened it up, because in my day, this is where I hitch my pants up and say, now kids, in my day, they made you retire after 5.
Oh, wow.
But for a time,
wait, they don't do that anymore?
No, you can play until you're gorged on your illicit
winnings.
But I
thought Ken Jennings made that problematic because he was there for 8 months.
Nope, they still do it. There's some guy on right now, I think, who's like rocking the house and taking
a while. The Brooklyn bartender?
Austin? Austin, yes. No, they retired us. But until that period was done, I was one of the top 100 players of the game.
Did you get leave from the military to go on the game show?
I'm a civilian, and thank you for opening that door, because I actually am not in the military, and I should also add, nothing I say here reflects the views of the United States government.
Or Jeopardy.
Or Harvard Extension School. Where
right, because by
teach.
The way, the United States government these days enjoys such a pristine, you know, reputation that really we wouldn't want to, you know, tarnish it, would we?
in all administrations, I always point out I don't speak for the government. But I was actually a young professor at Dartmouth College in those days. And a moment came after the game that took me down a peg for the rest of my life, because I was on Jeopardy. I won. I was also a young professor. I had my first teaching gig at an Ivy League school. I had my first book out. I thought I was just, you know, the cat's PJs. And one of my students walks up to me and he says, I saw you on Jeopardy. And I said, yeah, what'd you think? And he said, Professor Nichols, I had no idea you were so smart.
It took you being on a game show.
Yeah,
for me to
I was
really...
like, and I said to him, I said, you didn't think maybe the you know, the Ivy teaching job or the book or,
nope.
And he just kind of shook his head and he said, you know what I mean?
Oh, so speaking of being smart and smart people, you wrote an amazing book, which I think will prove, it's one of these books that is going to prove to be kind of way more prescient than you had hoped it would be.
Sadly.
Right, because the premise is terrifying, right? The premise is...
I mean, it's called The Death of Expertise.
Right.
Like, that's real intense.
Living in a time in which not only do people not know anything, they're sort of giddy about that fact.
So they're proud of it.
Describe that horrible situation and how we got here.
Well, it's always been the case, especially in American culture, that people don't like eggheads. I tell a story in the book. This actually happened when I was teaching up at Dartmouth. I'm actually from Western Massachusetts, and I grew up in
where?
Chicopee.
Ah. I'm from Springfield, dude.
Get out.
OMFG.
I took my driver's test at the Chicopee DMV because it was easier.
Because you guys are not as smart.
Yeah.
Basically.
Were you on your way to the Kielbasa Festival?
Absolutely. And then the Big E.
And then the Big E.
To rope some cows. All right. Back to Death of Expertise. Just had to have that moment there.
Well, since you know Chicopee, my brother ran a bar there. And to say that it was a bar is really a compliment. It was more like a joint. You know, and so I used to hang out with my brother. I'd come down from Dartmouth and I'd drive down,
nice.
Go see my family, and I'd hang out in the bar. And one night I'd leave, and a guy in the bar turns to my brother and he says, so your brother's a professor, huh? And my brother says, yeah. And he says, well, seems like a good guy anyway. Now, that's really common. That's a normal part of American culture. This distrust of intellectuals and pinheads. That's actually even a positive part of our culture, because we don't come from Europe. We don't call people hair doctor, professor, and all that academic rank stuff. On the other hand, what's happened now is that people are positively not just distrustful of experts, but believe they're smarter than experts. In other words, there's this incredible injection of narcissism into this now that says, you're not the boss of me. I'm smart enough to know about vaccines. I can read a medical journal article, and know whether or not this is real. And it's bleeding down into everything. I spoke to, when I wrote the book, I was talking to doctors, teachers, engineers, you name it. But I was also talking to people like photographers, and electricians and plumbers who all said, oh my God, if I have one more guy, you know, while I'm wiring a house, standing over me saying, so what are you using there? You know, 220, 221, you know, the Mr. Mom, right? 221, whatever it takes.
Is that the internet? Is that the sole
It's YouTube, right?
Of- well, in the book,
it's YouTube videos.
In the book, I attribute it to several things, all of which are part of this underlying growth of narcissism in American society. But the other influences are, yes, the internet. And I'll talk about that in a second because everybody, that's the go-to. Everybody says, well, it's the internet. But it's not. This predates the internet, I would say, going back to the 70s and the 80s. One is education. We now have a very therapeutic model of education, which is we don't really care whether the students are learning critical thinking and, you know, kind of going through their paces to become lifelong learners. We care about whether they're happy. We care about whether they're feeling fulfilled. There's no such thing as a really wrong answer. I mean, let's face it. The most common grade in American universities is an A. Mm-hmm. Well, that's, you know, I mean, Lake Wobegon is one thing. Lake what the hell is going on is a totally another. I mean, the world is not full of A students. The media play a big part in this because now the media are all segmented. You can spend all day getting your news and never encounter a view you disagree with. You can go anywhere. You don't read a newspaper anymore, right? I actually made the mistake. I teach undergraduates at night, and I made reference to an above the fold story in the newspaper, and the students all looked at me, and I said,
above the what?
Is that a website?
And I said, well, okay, there was once a time when papers were made of trees,
everything in air quotes. I went newspaper, trees,
printed with lasers, so they didn't really understand that a newspaper has a way of signaling what's important to you. And what you realize is that people don't read a newspaper. They search for stuff they already want to hear about. They don't, it's like reading a book by starting with the index and seeing if your name's in it, which I've never done, by the way.
No, none of us has ever done that. Yeah.
And finally, of course, the internet. Then it really is the internet because it's the magic answer box that everybody carries in their pocket that produces the illusion of being informed.
Actually knowing something.
Yes.
Right. Now, in the book, one of the things that I liked a lot about it is that you never conflate, you know, credentials with actual expertise. Mm. And it seems to be a distinction that many fail to make. So how do we get to real expertise if so much of our educational system is not necessarily geared towards it? Who are the classes that we still trust? How do we get that infrastructure up again?
Well, you know, part of the problem about credentials is that people now both resent them and don't take them seriously. Someone said, well, you think you're smart because you have a PhD. And I'm like, well, yeah, I think that's a certain. But on the other hand, then the next comeback is, well, you know, a lot of people have PhDs. Well, I can't deny that either anymore. This democratization of education has been lethal because it's brought, it's caused degree inflation that, you know, bachelor's degrees in a lot of schools. And I always make it a point to say, I think American education is still the best in the world. American universities are still the best, but there's a huge stratum of American universities that are doing nothing but filling in as replacement high schools now.
Yeah.
Which means that in order to show some college level achievement, people get master's degrees. And there's been a proliferation of that. And of course, all this is very expensive and it's very time consuming. And it means people defer growing up and getting married and having children and adulting. And I think it's just it's needless. So how do you replace that infrastructure? Well, part of it is longevity. I think, expertise. I actually talk in the book about what constitutes an expert. Dilettantes don't last very long in any field. There's more than just credentialing. There's peer review.
Including maybe, you know, being president. But we'll talk about that in a moment.
Well, you know, one thing that the president and others, like the Brexiteers, have done is to conflate the word expert with the word elite, which is wrong. I was an advisor to a U.S. senator some years ago. I was an expert. He was elite.
Yeah.
I was not the decision maker. So I think part of it is to reestablish this notion that There are things that are true. There are things that are false. There are areas that require expertise that you should rely on other people for, but that doesn't, but we have to get our egos out of the way, because I think partly what a lot of this rejection of expertise boils down to is a national temper tantrum of saying, you're not the boss of me. That when a doctor says, look, you gotta vaccinate your kid because we don't want to have whooping cough come back. And parents say, I don't like needles. You're not the boss of me. It really is a kind of, again, rooted in an excessive, and this is where it comes into contact with democracy, with a radical notion of democracy that is really a mobocracy rather than kind of the considered and thoughtful republic upon which the American experiment was founded. So I think this has really scrambled the partisan political situation, because there's really two parties now. There's the party of people who accept facts, and then there's kind of everybody else. And that party of everybody else, as much as people want to associate it with Trumpism, that really does cut across parties as well. I mean, there are people on the left where I have these completely hallucinatory discussions about things where, you know, again, it's, well, what I believe is what I believe. So I actually think the new cleavage in America is kind of between knowers and wishers, or knowers and believers rather than believers. Left and right. Yeah.
But what about, you know, sometimes you look at groups of experts, and as much as I kind of want to assign myself to one of these groups, you look at groups of experts and you see that they're just as susceptible as anyone else to these kind of, you know, bouts of groupthink, to yes. like really, really short-sightedness. You saw this with people prognosticating Brexit, prognosticating the election, and being, you know, 100% wrong just because kind of like some sort of ideological, you know, willful blindness. How do we explain that, and how do we treat that?
Well, experts, there's a whole chapter in the book called When Experts Are Wrong, including not just when they are wrong out of good faith, but when they are, oh, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for? Lying?
Yeah.
Fraud? you know, that's always a hazard. You could run into a doctor who's going to kill you. You could run into a dentist who's going to disfigure you. You could run across a lawyer who's going to put you in jail. But as I tell people, experts aren't always right. They're just more likely to be right than you are. And if they're wrong, they're more capable of learning from being wrong. I think one problem here is, of course, the public judges us on predictive ability, which is the weakest part of any sort of expertise. I mean, we're explainers. Now, scientists say, no, we have to do experiments to predict. But still, if you could predict every experiment, you wouldn't run them, because you learn from when they fail. The other thing, and I'll put in one last plug for experts here, is to say people treat expert failure like plane crashes. They're spectacular. It terrifies them. They focus on it to, you know, in the book, I take that bit from Rain Man, the movie Rain Man, mm-hmm. where the autistic character won't fly because he can remember every single crash that ever happened. Right. But people don't remember billions and billions and billions of miles safely traveled. The same people who say, the pilot could be drunk, or the pilot could be stupid, and pilots don't know what they're doing, are saying that while they're texting while driving.
Right. Yeah.
You know, because they have no sense of risk, because I'm smart and I'm in control. Exactly.
So Tom, you came with a gentilic question for us.
Mm-hmm. The question I had, because I had to think about this now, you know, especially if you live in the Northeast, well, do you want to ask about Jewish food? No, I've eaten plenty of it. But the one question I always had is about the way that groups treat each other in an undifferentiated way. So, you know, Jews are like this, Christians are like that, Gentiles are like this. So my question was, is there a group with whom Jews outside of Judaism, either ethnically or religiously, feel more comfortable? Is there a Gentile group who say, these are the guys we like to hang out with? And the example I brought up when talking about it with your producer was, I'm Greek Orthodox. People are always surprised to find out. They say, well, who's most like you in the world? The Catholics, right? And we say, no.
Yeah.
We have a lot of beefs with the Catholics. The Anglicans,
yeah.
Which is a really strange thing. No one ever thinks to put the Greek Orthodox, and the Anglicans together, but there's actually a lot of history. The greatest history of the Orthodox Church was written by an Anglican convert back in the 20th century. So that kind of sparked the question in my head. Is there an equivalent group outside of your community where you'd say, we're very comfortable with that group? Would they get us?
That's a great question.
Such a good question.
I'll take a first stab.
Yep.
For me, it's Armenians. For whom I make almost no differentiation. I mean, upon my first contact with Armenians, like, oh my God, hi, mishpocha, you know, hi, family. It's like, oh, you have a Holocaust, you're small and tribal, and you make good brandy. Like, hey, like, we're brothers.
For me, I mean, personally, it's so funny. Like you say, you're Greek Orthodox. I have a best friend from college who is Greek Orthodox, and I've always found it very easy because, like, the cultural aspect is very similar. So for me, I'm like, yeah, I get it. You got, you know, you have your special name for your grandmother. You, like, have a specific type of food you eat. Like, to me, I could more seamlessly.
We're Mediterranean.
Yeah, like, right. Yeah, you know. And so in addition to Irene, my cousin married a Greek woman who I love so much. And it feels like, I don't know, for me, the religions that have cultural aspects sort of bound up in them, I find very sort of, it's easier as opposed to Catholicism, which to me, I'm like, I don't get, like, it's hard to find an inroad there because.
Well, it is true. Greek Orthodoxy. I mean, it's, although, you know, it's interesting. Sometimes when I'm speaking to European audiences, I point out that I'm Eastern Orthodox and they say, well, you're a Russian. I said, no, the Orthodox Church, Armenians, you know, others. But it is true that that Greek Orthodoxy, I had a, when I was in college, I had a very serious relationship with a young Jewish lady. She came to church with me one time and, you know, we were doing the smells and the bells and the droning and the chanting. She leans over halfway through the service and says, sounds like my guys. Right. And I said, yeah,
she was every bit, you know, as bored as
we stole it from somewhere, you know.
You know, it's, first of all, I have to say to Stephanie, you know, who's dear friend Irene, we all know. I mean, Irene is basically Jewish. I mean,
oh, yeah,
you couldn't be more right. I mean, she reads as Jewish, and, you know, I've got good Judar, and if I met her, you know, without, you know, knowing, and I, that's of course the highest of compliments. But I mean, I hate to sound like a broken record, but my mind did go to the Greeks, and I've never had personally any close. I mean, I'm sure I've had friends with some Greek ancestry, none of my best friends were Greek. But my brother in college, two of his five best friends, I would say, were Anthony Philippakis and Anthony Kyriakakis. And
you made that up.
No.
Random name generator right now.
Here's the thing, guys. I really didn't. Dan hung with the Anthonys a lot. And you know, and one of them was much more, his family is much closer to immigration to Greece than the other, whose family I think had been here longer. But, you know, I hung with those guys a lot. So it's something I thought about in the years thereafter. Just kind of, you know, I had that question in my own mind. And, you know, you notice there are, first of all, you're talking about a people who, even the ones who are ostensibly religious, are often pretty funny and casual about it. There's not a kind of reverence for the clergy that you'll see in some traditions.
It was a shock to me to read Zorba the Greek and, you know, as kind of part of my own cultural education and realize that, you know, wow, Greeks in America are a lot more pious than, you know, Greeks.
So that's number one. Number two, intense pressure to marry within the faith.
Oh.
And it's really more within the culture. I mean, Greek Americans, even ones who aren't particularly church going, expect their kids will marry fellow Greek Americans very often, which is really interesting.
My father, whose first marriage was to a Polish American woman, and then he married my mother years later, who is Irish American, but she converted to Orthodoxy, Greek Orthodoxy. And yet there was intense pressure from my father to marry a Greek woman. And I finally just turned to her and I said, like you did twice. and I said, like my brother who married the Irish girl did, or my other brother who married the Protestant did.
Right.
And finally he just was quiet for a moment. He said, you know, just because the rest of us were stupid doesn't mean you have to be.
So did you?
Yeah.
I've been married twice and in neither case. So
That was your mistake.
That was, but you know.
For the third time, you need a Greek woman, Tom. Yeah,
well, and you know, we do accept two divorces within the Greek church. So I still got one.
So wait, when you were dating the Jewish girl, was there like, this is when we get to ask Gentiles, like what people really think of Jews. Like were your parents, was there like a pressure like, oh, don't date a Jewish girl. Date a Jewish girl.
But you know, here's the interesting moment because it was an intersection with Greeks. Now, this was not like dating wasps, right? You know, or coming from a wasp family, it was like, well, you know, not our people, right. The Hebrews, you know, that kind of thing. This was actually, my mother loved her, but said, she's a wonderful girl. She's beautiful. You clearly love her. I just hope you don't marry her. Because, not because she was Jewish, but because I was Greek Orthodox.
Right.
It was the pressure to marry within, it, you know, it, And of course, her family, her grandmother used to say, he's a nice Greek boy. When does he convert? And everybody was really rooting for both of us to convert on both sides, because nobody had an innate, I mean, it was actually a very heartbreaking situation, because there was no innate rejection from either side. The Jewish family did not reject the Greek boy. The Greek family did not reject the Jewish girl. But it was, which one of you will convert, because the religious, you know, line has to go on. And we, you know, eventually it just didn't work. And my priest, who's a wonderful guy, since retired, I think by the standards of Greek Orthodox, very liberal, very forward-looking priest, when he found out that was over, he just kind of went, you know, like, okay, so now I don't have to figure out what to do about this.
Crisis averted.
Yes, crisis averted. Exactly. And remember that, you know, the most famous Greek Orthodox politician in America is technically not in communion with the church, because he's married to a Jewish woman. Michael Dukakis.
Yeah. Michael Dukakis. Absolutely.
Tom, thank you so much for being here. Tom's latest book is The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters.
Thank you so much. Wonderful to be with you.
No queremos educarnos. No queremos más control.
All right. Our Jewish guest this week is the one and only David Litt. He's the author of Thanks, Obama, My Hopey Changey White House Years, which is about his time as a speechwriter in the Obama White House. He's now a writer-producer for Funny or Die in D.C. Welcome, David.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Hi, David.
So you and Liel actually have like been on the road together, swapping stories.
Veterans of the moth.
I think on the road makes it seem like we did some sort of Thelma and Louise type deal.
Right.
We did a show together.
Cocaine in the back of the bus.
Yeah, exactly. This was, what was it, San Antonio?
We both missed planes together.
Yeah, that's right.
So you guys were both on the moth.
Similar times.
Yeah, we were both in the same show at the Moth, the storytelling show on NPR.
And David, I can't even begin to describe what happened to that like 1,000-plus person arena when David told his story. It was like, it was amazing to watch. Like at some point,
wait, which story did he? I've read the whole book. Which story did he tell?
I told the story about the time I had to sing the Golden Girls theme song to President Obama in the Oval Office.
My favorite moment in the book, we can't not get to this, is that you – because I've been there. I've had to do this, but not with the president of the United States, is when you had to teach him how to say Chag Sameach for Happy Holidays. And it sounds like he never really got it. This was for his Passover message that he was recording. And it sounds like he sort of basically at the end was like, Chag Sameach, whatever, peace out. Did he get it? Did he nail it?
I wouldn't say he nailed it. He got close enough.
Chag Sameach.
And I think a lot of the book, I think, is the – experience of me saying I went to Hebrew school for a long time and never quite knew why I did that. And then certain things happened in the White House and I was like, oh, this was what all the Hebrew school was for.
For such a time as this.
Exactly.
Baby, right?
This was probably what they had in mind. They were like, one day you will have to teach the president to do like a ch sound. And when that happens, you're going to be glad that you did all this Hebrew school. And so, to be fair, that is not a sound that's easy if you didn't grow up sort of doing it or hearing it.
If you didn't grow up summoning camels to your herd.
Right, exactly.
It's a tough sound.
Well, what's funny to me is the I don't know if everybody is as picky about pronunciation, but just judging from my family, my small sample size of my family, people were incredibly demanding of President Obama's pronunciation of Hebrew. Where what I don't write about in the book was, so we worked for a while to get the Chag Sameach right, and we came close. And then the first thing that all of my family members said was not like, wow, you wrote a video for the president. That was so cool. It was like, I didn't really do so good with the Chag Sameach, huh? I was like, come on. Like, he's not Jewish. This isn't his, he doesn't speak this language. But
you're like, what is wrong with
you
people?
Why is this a requirement? But actually, that wasn't the only issue with the speech, right? He actually rewrote one of the lines in the Passover address.
He did, yeah. So I had, in that speech or in that video, I had written, in every generation, there are those who have tried to destroy the Jewish people, sort of cribbing from the Haggadah, a little dark. And I should have known that was sort of, he was comfortable saying something like that, but that kind of doom and gloom was not his style. And so he read it and was like, wait a second, what's going on here? Like, isn't this a little depressing? And so we tried to explain, Because he was like, the whole thing is everyone's trying to kill us. Let's have some matzah. And we were like,
welcome. Yeah,
a little bit. Like that. Actually, is a pretty good summary of a lot of Jewish history. But by that point, I think he was just like, no. I'm gonna redo this a little bit. So he took the he asked for a pen, which this never happened, at least to me, any other time. But he was like, someone give me a pen, and he rewrote it. And I think he kept the idea, but he changed it to, you know, there are those who have targeted the Jewish people or something like that, a little less apocalyptic, you know, and still had some matzah in the general framework of things.
So not only are you the Jewish people's emissary in the White House, you are the administration's emissary in your family, which I imagine is actually way more difficult and annoying, right? Because are you blamed for like the Iran deal and stuff around dinner tables? Like, what is their level of expectation when you come home for Shabbat dinner?
Well, so
tell the president that he should really outlaw cheese, like stuff like that.
That sort of thing definitely happens. Not cheese specifically, yeah. But you know, dairy more broadly.
Right.
the nice thing about my job in the White House was that there were actually emissaries to the Jewish community and also sort of people who were there to speak for the Jewish community in the White House. And I was not one of those. I was writing speeches. So I didn't have that responsibility. Absolutely, one of the things about writing speeches for the president or doing any job in the White House is that your family immediately assumes you have direct access to the leader of the free world. And so—
Whenever you want.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would get emails from my grandpa and like late at night, and he'd be like, well, like many older people, I couldn't sleep. So here's my plan for a national network of water pipelines to carry, because he would say, you know, some areas have drought and some areas are flooded. So what if we built pipelines next to the highways? And I actually thought it was very endearing. Like there was something very hopeful about the idea that somebody could just say like, you know, I'm a citizen. I know somebody. Maybe this will happen. Maybe this, Irving Lit National Network of Water Pipelines will one day exist. I tried to explain, like, Grandpa, I can't just walk into the president's office and say, by the way, could we do a multi-trillion-dollar infrastructure project?
Like Zadie called.
Yeah. He thinks it's a good idea, and he has a funding mechanism. It didn't compute. Like, he'd be like, well, could you at least show it to your people? And I was like, I don't have people. Like, I am somebody's people.
Now, here's kind of like something that always— When I was reading the book, kind of like was at the back of my mind, on some level, it's like this great big dream job. But another, like, you're the kid who started off by, you know, instead of drinking, going to do stand up and like being the funny writer. And then all of a sudden you come into a job where the expectation is, yeah, you should be funny. You should tell jokes. But at the same time, the person telling the jokes is the commander in chief. And so you want to be really super, really careful that you don't, you know, do any damage or get anything wrong. How do you strike that balance? Is it not like totally paralyze you that the wrong word, the wrong punchline may be funny, but like totally spark some sort of diplomatic incident?
Well, what we tried to do pretty carefully was recognize that when you're writing jokes for a president, a lot of the joke is that it's the president telling a joke.
Right.
So, right, like the one I always use is in 2013, President Obama said, all the Republicans agree they need to do a better job reaching out to minorities. This was a simpler time, but he said they all need to do a better job reaching out to minorities. Call me self-centered, but I could think of one minority that could start with, which when I say it is like, eh. But for him to say that was going farther than he had gone before. So some of it's just kind of always keeping in mind what you're saying.
It's a great joke.
He's the president. You know, he's going to be the president the day after the joke, and that he was the president the day before the joke. And this is not the most important thing that he has to do. So we didn't joke about, let's say, national security for that reason.
So these are at the White House correspondence dinners. These are not like in random speeches.
Oh, yeah, that would be weird. Yeah, there probably is some context that's useful. Yeah, so these would be at the White House correspondence dinners. So in addition to... most of the year I would spend doing serious speeches, and then 1 month out of the year I would kind of switch over and do jokes for the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Although 1 year in 2014, President Obama went to address Steven Spielberg's the Shoah Foundation, talking about Holocaust remembrance and you know how we think about never again and never forget. And then also the White House Correspondents' Dinner was the week before. So I was doing both speeches simultaneously. And that was really weird.
Because you're like, I can't put one speech, like you have to make sure to keep them separate.
Yeah. In the sitcom version of my life, I totally put like the Holocaust memorial speech where the joke should have been. And then the president got up and to talk about remembering the Holocaust and like tells a bunch of jokes. But thankfully that did not happen.
Knock, knock. Who's there? The Holocaust. The Holocaust who? You said you'd never forget.
You have to tell everyone the joke that Nussbaum wrote, Jeff Nussbaum, which Obama never used, which was so funny.
So the joke, really quickly. So Vice President Biden said, you know, the president has a big stick talking about foreign policy, but making a gesture that did not look like a foreign policy gesture. And so the joke was, my vice president's out there talking about my big stick. Let's just put it this way. Dreams aren't the only thing I got from my father. And we didn't think that that was ever going to end up in the speech. But there was kind of this point where we're like, that is such a good joke. And it's so clearly not appropriate for the president to say out loud that we just have to run it by him. And so he enjoyed it, although it was very clear that it was never going in there.
David Litt, thank you so much for being here. The book is Thanks, Obama, My Hopey, Changey White House Years. It is bizarre to read it in like the Trump era.
Yes.
When the things that were inappropriate then are just like
first as joke, then as policy.
So it's a nice like TBT to a simpler time. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Live show. Guys, this is the last warning you're going to get from us. The last promise, shall we say. October 25th, we're back at the JCC Manhattan. Tickets are on sale now. Our guests are Kobe Labee from Transparent and AJ Jacobs, who has his new book out about DNA and DNA testing. And we are actually going to talk about our own DNA test. We're going to reveal our own ancestry. Just how Jewish are we? We're going to have the big reveal. Anyway, bring your friends. October 25th, jccmanhattan.org is where you get tickets. Mazel tov. Stephanie, what do you got?
I actually have a bunch to get through. This is a big week for everyone. I have from friend of the show, Miriam Kruel. We have a mazel tov to Rebecca Schmierer and Aaron Springett on their engagement.
Schmierer.
What?
I just said Schmierer because it's a cool name.
I don't know what their hashtag will be, but it'll be something good, some combo of those last names. I also want to shout out Kevin Brown and Kate Levin, who just got engaged as well. And, you know, my new sister-in-law, Sarah Cohen, ran her first half marathon this past weekend, and I'm super proud of her. Most importantly, though, it's Grandpa Al's birthday this week.
Aw, mazel tov, Grandpa Al.
He turns 86 on October 22nd, and I am so excited. I got to pop that card in the mail so it gets there on time. But, you know, love that guy.
I wish he could be my Grandpa Al.
So speaking of marathons, my mazel tov is to Peter Chacha, the president of New York Roadrunners, and the person who is handling, making sure that the marathon goes off without a hitch, 20 days exactly from today. And what a pleasure.
My shout out is I have a shout out and then a mazel tov. My shout out is to Miriam Lichtenberg, who is up at Barnard and is recruiting friends to listen. She's a new fan and a huge supporter, and her letter just meant a lot to us this week. And then a big mazel tov to Paul Miller, who has been a math teacher at Ne'er Israel in Baltimore for 78 years. His granddaughter writes that he holds the American record for the most consecutive years teaching. He's taught children and grandchildren of his first students. He was inducted into the National Teachers Hall of Fame, and on Tuesday, he turned 101.
Aww.
So happy birthday, Paul
Mazel
Miller.
Tov.
Keep it up. And we'll hope to be wishing you a happy birthday next year, too. Wait. If you're the kind of person who skips past the closing credits, don't, because this week there are a lot of cool shout-outs embedded in those closing credits. All right, ready? All right, here we go. Unorthodox is brought to you by Tablet Magazine on the web at tabletmag.com. Write to us at unorthodox@tabletmag.com. As you know, we do read our mail, and we read a lot of it on the air. Follow Stephanie on Instagram at sbutnick. We are on Facebook a lot, so follow Tablet Magazine there. This week, our show was produced by Shira Talushkin with help from Julia Frakes. Our artwork is by Esther Werdiger. Our show is edited by Noah Levinson. Our music is by Golem, and rabbinic supervision this week by all of the great pulpit rabbis, those rabbis who deliver those kick-ass sermons whom you wrote in to tell us about. For example, Rabbi Michael Bernstein, Rabbi Noah Arno, Rabbi Scott Shaffron, Rabbi Dusty Klass, Rabbi Aaron Brusso in Mount Kisco, Rabbi Stephanie Colin, Rabbi Shira Milgram, Rabbi Tom Weiner, Rabbi David Stern, Rabbi Lawrence Siebert, Rabbi David Ellenson, and Rabbi Molly Kane. Kosher Slaughtering this week by Little Bob Corker. We record at Argo Studios, which is sick of escargot jokes, and we're proud to be part of the Panoply Network. Shalom, friends.